thank you for the introduction and for the invitation. So my talk is somewhat of an outlier here. I won't speak about data analysis. Maybe at the last slide I will mention some questions. So it's about computational geometry, though, and its applications to optimal transport. And it's a summary of many joint works with many co-authors, which I will mention along. And the overview is as follows. I will first try to show the relationship between optimal transport and the notion of Laguerre diagram, which are also called additively weighted Voronoi diagrams in computational geometry, and how these Laguerre diagrams form a very efficient tool to discretize optimal transport and to solve optimal transport problems. And then I will discuss two applications of this discretization of optimal transport to unrelated topics. So this is to convince you that it's quite versatile and show you some applications of optimal transport. So you might not know about optimal transport, so I will describe it shortly. So here you have two probability densities which represent, for instance, a distribution of sand on some domain X and two piles of sand which you want to transport. So you want to transport X, the probability density over X to Y. And you assume that moving a grain with mass dm from a point x to a point y costs you c of xy dm, where c is a given function. And the optimal transport problem is the following question: what is the cheapest way of moving the sand from the distribution rho to y, to nu? Okay, and more formally, what you are searching for is a transport map. So this is a map from x to y. And what you want is that if you look at any subset of y and you look at its inverse image, then the integral of rho over this inverse image, so the density contained in this image, should be equal to the integral of nu over b. And the optimal transport problem is, as I say, to minimize the transport code. So this is this integral here. But I will describe a discrete version soon, which is perhaps more understandable. And it has many, many applications in mathematics, so in the study of PDEs, to establish functional inequalities, optimal functional inequalities, in probability theory and geometry, and also more recently in computer graphics, machine learning, inverse problems, and so on. The list goes on. And actually, this can be seen if you look at the number of articles which contain the word optimal transport in Google Scholar, so it's kind of increasing very fast. And there is a question of how do you compute optimal transport plans? And in order to do that, you need to discretize your space and your probability measures. And the most obvious solution is to discretize both source and target by a finite sum of direct masses, so by a finite sets. And then optimal transport is equivalent to what is called assignment problem in a combinatorial optimization, which is not so easy. The cost of the best algorithm is more than quadratic. Then you can do use a PDE approach. Say I have two probability densities. I will write the optimal transport problem as a resolution of some PDE, and then I discretize this PDE. So this is the second approach. And the third one, which I would like to emphasize, is to make the assumption that the source has a density. It remains a continuous density. But the target is a finitely supported, so it's a supported over finite set. And there is a discrepancy. Either you have a very general algorithm, which makes no assumption on the cost function, but which are computationally expensive. Or you can have computationally very efficient algorithm, but which are restricted to cost function, which are geometric in some sense. And in our setting, geometric means that you are able to compute efficiently the Laguerre diagram or the weighted Voronoi diagrams for C. Okay, so I will describe this setting. So again, the same picture, but here the source is a probability density and the target is a finite supported probability measure. And the transport map here, it's much easier to describe. You take a direct mass here, you look at its inverse image, and you want that for every y, the integral of rho over this inverse image should be equal to the new I in front of y. Okay. But here, the set of transport maps is really huge. In some sense, it's contained in the set of measurable partitions of the set X. So it's infinite, uncountable, what you want. But fortunately, we are not searching for any transport map, but we are looking for an optimal transport map. And this induces regularity of the partitions that you obtain, and the partitions that you are interested in are much smaller. They form a finite dimensional set. And they are related to von Heiderhams and Lager cells. Okay, so let me describe, have a very fuzzy economical analogy to explain what's going on. So here, imagine this is a city. And in a gray scale, you describe the density of population. And in Y, so the set Y is a set of location of bakeries. So people want to buy a bread or croissant, whatever. And they are lazy, so they go to the closest bakery. So this describes, this induces a decomposition of the domain into Voronoi cells. And if the price of bread is uniform, really people go to the closest bakery. So what happens here is that the bakery that's at the center of the city will get almost all the customers. So it will be, in some sense, overworked, and what it will exceed the capacity of what it's able to produce. So how do you solve this problem? You set up prices, non-uniform prices. This means that this bakery here at the center will increase the price of bread, and people here, they will make a compromise. They will try to minimize not only the distance, but the distance plus the price. And by doing so, they define the different decomposition of the domain, and these cells shrink. Okay? And this is what I call the Lager diagram, this decomposition. And what's very easy to prove, actually, it's a three line, that is that the Lager diagram induces an optimal transport. So Lager diagrams always induce optimal transport maps between the density rho and the measure, which is supported over the bakeries, and the mass in front of each Dirac is the amount of customers attracted to this bakery. Okay. So now the question becomes, I know how to build optimal transport maps, but I don't control what is the image. The image is the distribution of customers. So now what I can do is to play with price, and hopefully, if I set the price right, I can make sure that each bakery gets exactly, let's say, 1/5 of the customers. Okay? So it's a finite dimensional problem, but still, you want to solve a nonlinear system of equations, it's not trivial. And this was first remarked by Gangbu and Mike Kahn in 96, I think, and this led to an algorithm which basically works by adjusting the price bakery by bakery in a monotonous way. But the complexity of this algorithm is quite bad. It's n cube over epsilon, where epsilon is the desired precision. And I think because of this bad complexity, people thought that this is not a suitable approach for optimal transport discretization or for large-scale optimal transport computations. But actually, Oranhammer, Hoffman, and Aronoff remarked in 98 that finding prices that solve the optimal transport problem is equivalent to maximizing a concave function. They make this remark, but they did not exploit it numerically. So the first approach are numerical experiments are more recent, and there was a very important improvement in complexity using this variational formulation, so the optimization problem. But there was no convergence analysis. And more recently, there is a method that I will sketch a little bit later, Newton's algorithm, which converges very fast, and I will show some images to suggest this, to explain that, under rather general assumption on the density and the cost. Okay, so let me show some examples to explain what I'm talking about. So here the source is uniform on 0,1 squared, so on the unit square. And the target is uniform over IID points, uniform points in the square. So I think there are 30 points, or maybe 100, I don't remember. And here, so this is the Voronoi diagram. You start with uniform prices, so you get the Voronoi diagram. And what happens is that some cells are too small, they don't have enough mass, and some cells are too large because they get a large fraction of the mass. And here, this is the amount of mass that is misallocated. meaning that the discrepancy between the uniform distribution of customers and what you get here. So then you do one step of Newton, and this improves quite a lot. And as you can see, for instance, the small cell here has become bigger, this large cell has become smaller, and so on. And you can do it a second time, and here you have numerical precision almost. Okay, so this Newton's algorithm is really quite efficient, and not only on simple examples like this. Okay, so this is a simple example in the sense that the distribution of bakeries is uniform. So the Voronoi diagram is not such a bad guess. But you can do a much more extreme case where all the bakeries are located here in the square 0, 1, third squared. So here, this bakery gets a lot of customers, this one also, so there is a large discrepancy between the uniform distribution of customers and the one that you obtain by setting zero prices. You can do an iteration of Newton, you get this, and second iteration, and then you're at 10 minus 6, so it's almost converged. And the point that I want to make here is that the points do not move, only the prices move. Okay? And this, so, okay. It's something that might not be surprising to a computational geometry audience, but to applying mathematics, it's not so obvious. Okay, so the Laguerre diagrams are able to encode the actual transport of mass on large movements. Okay, so this was the introduction, and now I will speak about the first application to a non-imaging optic problem. So the problem is as follows, it's called the inverse reflector problem. And before describing the inverse reflector problem, I will describe the forward problem. And the forward problem is as follows. So you have a probability density over the sphere, which tells you, which describes a perfect source of light which is located at zero. So it describes, if you look at the amount of mass in the certain portion of the spheres, it corresponds to the amount of light that is sent towards these directions. Okay? And you have also a reflecting surface, S. And now, for every ray, you intersect it with the reflector, and you compute the reflected ray, and you consider it just as a point in the sphere also. So you forget the position in space, you just remember the direction. Okay? And the forward problem is just the ray tracing problem. You start with the probability density, you push it forward through T, so you do the ray tracing, and you get a probability density over the sphere, which corresponds to the distribution of light that you get at infinity. Okay, so this is the forward problem. And now the inverse problem is, suppose you are given such a source, and you want to get a certain illumination at infinity, so you want to prescribe the illumination. How do you recover the surface? Okay, so in the first problem, you had the source and the surface. In the second one, you have two probability measures, and you want to find the surface. And actually, this problem occurs in many applications. So for instance, in the design of car beams, in the design of public lighting, in hydroponic agriculture, in any cases where you want to prescribe the distribution of light energy. So it's called non-imaging optics, because you don't want to produce images. You just want to prescribe the distribution of light energy. Okay. And there is a zoology of a similar optics problem with various types of sources, lenses, various types of targets, and so on. Okay, so now let me describe the semi-discrete version of this problem. And maybe let's make it very, very simple by saying you only want to send light in one direction. So in this case, the answer is known from 2,000 years, perhaps. And the solution is a paraboloid of revolution, which is focalized at zero, and which sends all the rays towards the direction y. So if you want to send all the light in one direction, it's quite obvious to do so. You just take a paraboloid of revolution. So notice that there is one free parameter in the paraboloid of revolution. There is a focal distance, okay, which I denote ky. Now, if you want to send the light in three directions, well, you take intersection of solid paraboloids, and then you take the boundary. all the rays that will hit the first paraboloid go towards y, the rays that hit the second paraboloid will go to another direction, and so on. And now the distribution that you get in infinity might not be the one that you want, like in the bakery example. So what you can do now is play on the focal distances of the paraboloids by making it closer. So if y does not have enough light, then you make it closer, it will receive more light because it will receive the more rays will be reflected towards y. Okay. And as I said, it can be adjusted, so you can adjust by playing with focal distances. And the focal distances, they really play exactly the same role as the prices in the economic example. Okay, and what's very funny and very surprising and actually rigidly tied to this specific case is that this set Vy of k, so the set of rays that will hit the y's parabolis first, is actually a Laguerre cell on the sphere. For a cost function which is unusual, it's not the Euclidean distance or the squared Euclidean distance, it's minus log of 1 minus the scalar product. It's quite easy to see actually, but I won't do that. And so there is an equivalence between the semi-discrete inverse reflector problem and semi-discrete optimal transport problem on the sphere for this cost. So now we played with this idea with Boris Tiber and Pedro Machado to do some numerics. And so this is just, I will show a few examples. So here you start with the equivalent of the Voronoi cells. And in the end, you want a uniform lighting. And the measure at the source is a uniform measure over the half sphere. So the light is uniform on the half sphere. And the target is the sum of direct masses which discretize the picture of Gaspard Monge. Okay, so this is the starting point. Some cells get too much light. You adjust the focal distances using the same algorithm. You get a uniform decomposition of the sphere. And if you use this to build a reflector and you compute the actual image that you obtain, you get something that looks a little bit like the picture of Monge. It's not very nice because the distribution is, the discretization is very poor. But you can play the same game with more direct masses. So you get a Laguerre diagram, which is much bigger, and you get a much better picture. So these results were obtained using the variational formulation, but not with the quasi-Newton algorithm, the damped Newton algorithm that I mentioned, which restricted the resolution to such sizes. But using the recent algorithm that I described, it's possible to go to much higher resolution. So basically what you do here, you discretize the image by setting one direct mass at every pixel. Okay, so there is a lot of direct masses. So I don't show the Laguerre diagram because you don't see anything. It's too tiny, the cells are too tiny. What I show here is the reflector. So this is a smooth surface, and here I display the mean curvature of the reflector. And this is a resillimated image, so it's very, very close to the original one. And you can see that, for instance, here in the dark part, you want no light, which means that there will be a singularity or a region with a large mean curvature in the reflector. Okay, so there is a relationship between, you can recover information about the regularity of the solution of the optimal transport problem during these computations. Okay, so now let me say a few words about this damped Newton algorithm, which I did not describe. So first, I will introduce this notation, the map G. So it maps a function, a set of prices, to the distribution of customers. Okay, so it maps a function on Y to another function on Y, which is a probability measure. And I will look only at points that lie in an admissible domain. And the admissible domain is such that all the cells have non-empty mass. So this is something that is absolutely crucial, is to maintain this property over the course of the algorithm. Okay. So you want to solve G of psi equals nu. So you compute some epsilon through this formula. Let's not care about that. And at every iteration, you compute the Newton point using the usual formula, but it might be that when you go to the Newton point, some of the cells get empty and get no light at all, or no customers if you want. This means that if it's empty, locally the function g is constant, which means that when you look at the derivative of g, it will have a row with zeros, so it's not invertible, so you could not do a further Newton step. So what you do instead is to say, I go to the Newton point, it's not good, so I backtrack. I take the half between the Newton point and the former position. And I do that enough time so that I go back to this set E epsilon. So I backtrack until all cells get some customers. And it's quite easy to, I mean, it's a standard proposition. It's quite easy to prove that the algorithm converges globally, this Newton's algorithm, if dg is negative definite. We'll explain why we have this in a minute. And if the map g is smooth. So it seems that this proposition is quite standard, and it could be obvious how to apply it to optimal transport. But in the end, showing these two properties is quite difficult and involves, I think, interesting ideas, which I will try to sketch very, very briefly. So the theorem that we have in the reflector case is that if X is an hemisphere, if the density, the source density, is smooth enough, then the damped Newton algorithm converges globally. If it's smooth enough, and more importantly, if the support of the density is connected. So this is really the important assumption. And why is it important? So let's take a look at the function g. So recall that the function g associates to every point, to a given set of price, the integral of rho over each cell. So it's quite clear that if you look at, for instance, this point y, and you take the derivative with respect to a certain price z, then this derivative will be non-zero, if and only if the two cells y and z intersect. Because if you change the price here, it will not affect this cell, okay? So actually, if you look at the matrix induced by the derivative of g, so this matrix has a non-zero, if and only if, so this is the definition of the matrix, and this is the definition of the graph H, which joins two points if the matrix has a positive entry. Okay, and actually, it's because of what I said, it's not difficult to see that the matrix H is actually the one skeleton of the decomposition of the domain by the Laguerre cells. And if the domain is connected, then it's a connected graph. And so, because it's a connected graph, L is a graph Laplacian, so you can show quite easily that the kernel of L is just the constant functions. And this gives you the strong monotonicity. Okay, so this is the first step. And then for the smoothness, it's actually a bit more tedious. And it relies heavily on a quite hidden convexity property of Laguerre cells. So in the reflector case, if you look at the Laguerre cells as cells on the sphere, even for the distance, the square distance on the sphere, they are not convex. But there is a miraculous fact is that there exist maps which are called C exponential maps, there is one such map per point y, such that if you look at the Laguerre cell y and you take its inverse image by this C exponential map, it's always convex. Okay, so it means, for instance, that in this case, the Laguerre cells are always connected, which is not obvious from the definition. So actually, it's a very restrictive condition, asking that the Laguerre cells are always connected regardless of the distribution of psi, but which is satisfied for the reflector problem and for some similar problems. And actually, what I find very interesting and very intriguing is that this condition was introduced not for algorithm or for discretization, but for the regularity theory of optimal transport, like the regularity of Monge-Ampère equations. So it's quite surprising that it also appears in this discrete problems. Okay. So now I will switch to the second application, which is enforcing incompressibility in fluid dynamics, let's say. And I will start with a theorem by Arnold, which says that if you look at the Euler equations for incompressible fluids, so it's not very important if you don't understand this part, I will switch to the discretization soon. So the solutions, smooth solutions to Euler's equation for incompressible fluids are geodesics in the space of diffeomorphism of the domain, which preserves the volume, okay, which you regard as a subset of this Hilbert space. Okay, so this is a formal statement in the sense that it requires smooth solutions. And the question that was raised by Yann Brunier is, what about minimizing geodesics? So you are given two diffeomorphisms that preserve the volume of a certain domain. So two, I will explain it a little bit better after. So you are getting two measure-preserving diffeomorphisms of a certain domain, and you want to connect them by a path of diffeomorphism which preserves the volume and which minimizes this integral, which measures the energy that is spent by particles to go from their original position to their final ones. And actually, if you look at this problem, there is no classical solution. You need to relax, and you get what's called generalized geodesics, which I won't describe very carefully. And what's more interesting, perhaps, is that in many cases, in dimension 2, if you solve this problem and you look at the generalized geodesics, there is a sort of non-deterministic behavior of fluid particles. So in the particles that come from one point might split, follow two different paths, and join in the end, which is something that you do not expect physically, but there are still nonetheless solution, formal solution to Euler's equation. So what we wanted to do is to get a numerical understanding of this non-determinism. Okay, so let me describe the discretization. So we have a certain number of particles T, and we have a certain number N, and a certain number of time steps T. So at time E, the particles are described by their position MI1 to MIN, and which are gathered in a vector. And the analogous of this problem, the discretization of this is just the sum of the square distances between successive positions. So it's actually quite easy to discretize. But then there are these two conditions, the fact that S preserves the volume, and the fact that S0 is equal to S star and S1 is equal to S power star. So for the boundary condition, we use penalization, but the question is, how do you do with the incompressibility? How do you enforce that S preserves the volume measure? And one difficulty is that a point cloud is not incompressible in the sense that it never fills the space. So actually what we will do, we will use a penalization of incompressibility using optimal transport. So this is the idea that I would like to make you understand how to do that. And actually it's a very, very natural idea which probably came up also for other applications such as optimal quantization. So you are given a bunch of points, M1, MN, and you define this squared distance. So it's actually a distance, it's a squared Wasserstein distance for those who know. So you compute the minimum transport cost between the uniform density and the measure, the empirical measure over the point. Okay, so this gives a figure which measures how close your point is from being incompressible in some sense. Or, let's say, not incompressible, but evenly distributed. So if you start with a random point cloud in the unit square, you take x to be the unit square, and you compute this distance, this gives you something like that. This is 0.031, it's quite small, because the point is quite evenly distributed. But then you can still compute the gradient of this distance, so these are the arrows, and I rescale it, I won't explain why, but I rescale it. And if you look at now, each point you move it towards the direction of this gradient with this scaling, what you get is something extremely uniform. Okay. And this is something that has been used a lot in, I think there is this article by Mathieu Desbrun and Fernando de Gauss about the blue noise sampling, and this is really this idea as well. Okay, so now let's start with a configuration which is not as incompressible, which is more concentrated in the interior. Then, as you can see, the square distance, or the distance, this ds, is much larger. Before, it was 0.03. And now, if you compute the gradient, well, it's something that really wants to move points towards a more uniformly distributed set of points. And if, again, you compute the gradient step, what you get is this. Okay. Okay, so let me now explain. So the problem that we solve now is the following. So we want to minimize. So this is the action. So we have a sequence of point clouds, M1, Mt. So this is the energy that is spent to move Mi to Mi plus 1. So this is the squared Euclidean distance, standard. Then we want M0 to be close to some prescribed position of particles. So what you want to do is to prescribe the position of particles at the beginning and at the end. And you want to prescribe this and also to enforce the fact that in the middle, the point clouds remain close to incompressible. So let me do maybe a tiny example, which is the following. Imagine that you are working on X, which is the disk. I think I cannot set it down. So you have X equal to the disk, and you want to connect S star equal to the identity to S big star equals to minus the identity. So you want to connect particle to the opposite position. So what I want to point is that the standard way to construct this interpolation is just to say, let's interpolate linearly. This is the if there was no third term, if there was no incompressibility, what you would do is basically try to draw x point h to the opposite point minus x. And what happens if you look at time 1/2? Then x plus minus x is 0 divided by 2 is 0. So all the points get at the origin. So you get a mass, a direct mass at the origin. Okay, so this is not incompressible at all. And imposing incompressibility will force you to follow a different path than the straight lines. Okay. Okay, so let's continue. And actually, in order to minimize this, it's not so easy, because first it's a non-convex optimization problem. So what we do is a quasi-Newton, like gradient descent, if you want. And at each step, we need to compute optimal transport for each point cloud, at each step of the descent, and for each time step, we need to compute an optimal transport problem. So it's actually a good stress test for optimal transport solvers. Okay, so now let me give an idea of what are the so-called generalized solutions. So here in what I described, we saw these points N, M as a sequence of point clouds. But actually, you could also say I fix an initial position and I follow a particle, and then I associate to K the piecewise linear path, which is the trajectory of the particle over time. So instead of having a sequence of point clouds, I could say I have a family of trajectories. So it's equivalent point of views. So now you can say I associate a probability measure over the set of trajectories, which is empirical measure over this path. Okay, so you get a probability measure over the set of continuous paths. And actually, what we were able to prove with Jean-Marie Mirbeau is that under suitable assumptions on the underlying generalized geodesic, and also under suitable choice of lambda, the minimizers of this discrete problem converge as n goes to infinity, as the number of points and the time step go to infinity, to what's called a generalized minimizing geodesic. which is a probability measure over the space of paths. Okay, so what's quite interesting is that here it seems that you discretize the classical problem, but in the end we can recover this general geodesic, and we'll show on some picture what they look like. Okay. So the first numerical result is exactly the one I described here, is the inversion of the disk. And there is a classical solution in the sense deterministic. And the solution with minimum energy, which enforces the incompressibility, is just the rotation by pi or by minus pi. So this is the classical solutions. And I describe them as a sequence of diffeomorphism, if you want. But you can also associate a measure on the set of paths, just by saying I follow, for each point I do a half turn. So this gives me a path, and I take the probability measure over the set of paths. So this is a classical solution. But because the problem is a convex optimization problem, not the one I showed, but the generalized geodesic problem, it's a convex optimization problem, any linear combination of solutions is also a solution. Which means that you could say I take a linear combination of the rotation by pi and the linear combination of the rotation by minus pi, which means that every point splits into, follows the different paths and joins in the end. Okay. This is also a solution. But it's not such a bad solution in the sense that if you look at its support, so its support lives in the set of paths, it's actually equal to 2. And why is it equal to 2? Just because the trajectory is determined by the initial position of a point plus plus or minus 1. So it's a union of two graphs, if you want. But there are more wild solutions, which were constructed by Yann Brunier, and which are as follows. So I just described the support of the measure, not the measure itself. And basically, the trajectories, what do? They follow ellipsoids. So they follow, the trajectories are like this. And there is a relationship that needs to be satisfied between the point position and its speed at t equals 0. So here it's a non-deterministic solution, as before, because the particle split before joining. But what is more striking is that the dimension of the support is not 2, it's 3. Because there are actually R2 cross R2, so this is 4, but there is a relation, so you get 3. And so this is what we recover numerically using this this optimization procedures that I described. So we have 10,000 points in the disk, and we have 17 time steps. And what I display here are some trajectories. And so for instance here, if you look at all the trajectories whose original point at t equals 0 emanates from this red circle, actually, you can see that they fill up almost all the disk. So this is widely non-deterministic. All the trajectories at the point, they split, they fill the disk, and then they join again. And same if you look for many points in the disk, you get the same behavior. So now let me... So in some sense, the numerics here are not so interesting because they confirm something that was known to mathematicians. But now let me switch to another problem where the solution is not known. And it's called the Beltrami flow in the square. So what I display here is a solution to Euler's equation. So basically you have particles, they travel in time. So you get, so I color them with some color so you can see a little bit how the movement goes. So basically this thing goes and turns and swirls around. Okay, and so what you do is you take this at the initial position for, so you set up 4 experiments, you take this as the initial position, and then you take this as the final position. So it has moved, but just a little bit, so it's not a very wild movement. Then you go a little bit further, so this here, you go a little bit further, this here, and so on. Okay, and now you solve and you try to find the interior pictures here. And these are the reconstructed generalized geodesics. So for t less than 1, you recover something that looks a lot like the classical solution. And this is predicted by a result of Brunier, which says that there is a threshold if t is less than 1, so if you are here, you should recover a classical solution, and if t is larger than 1, you should recover a generalized solution. But they don't, well, nobody knows what they look like. Okay, so from the 0.9, you have this, and then if you go to 1.1, so above 1, you can see that there is some weird things happening here. And what happens is that it's cheaper. So the blue wants to go in a counterclockwise manner. So as you can see, it goes like this. So it goes counterclockwise. But at the interior, it goes clockwise, because it's cheaper for it to go clockwise in the interior. And the further you go, if you take the final time to be 1.3, this effect is stronger. And 1.5 is even stronger. So now you might wonder, is this example simpler than the... Well, how does it compare? How does the complexity of the solution compare to the complexity of the disk inversion? Okay, so let me first show some pictures. So this is the trajectories for the disk inversion emanating from a point. And these are the same trajectories for the square emanating from a disk. And it's clear that here the trajectories fill up the space much less. So in some sense, this solution is more deterministic or less non-deterministic. And it would be interesting to quantify this. And what we did, and this is maybe the only part where I will mention the high-dimensional data analysis, and actually I think it's very relevant, is what we did, it's something very simple. We computed an estimation of the Minkowski dimension of the support. So basically, we compute for each of the support of the solutions, which are probability measure over a set of paths. We compute the minimum radius required to recover the support with n balls. Okay, so this is delta n. And we display the log n over log of 1 over delta n. And if the support of mu was manifold, this would converge to this would converge in the exact case to the dimension of the manifold. So this is for the Beltrami flow on the square, and you can see that for t equals 0.9, you recover a dimension of 2, which is a classical solution. This is for the disk, you get something that is slightly above 3. But now if you look at the intermediate times, you recover a dimension that seems to be strictly between 2 and 3. Okay, so there is a natural question that one might ask, is there some sort of a fractal structure in the solution of in the general solution for the Beltrami flow? Actually, we don't know. And I must mention here, before switching to the conclusion, that actually this is not a very good way of estimating the dimension, because here we are not working with mu, but with the support of the measure. But we don't know that the support converges. We just know that the measure converges. So we know that the sequence of discrete measures converges to a generalized solution. So actually what we would like to be able to do is to compute, to estimate the dimension of a measure in some sense. And so I don't know how to do that, so this is why we did this experiment. But actually, I think it's an interesting question here. Okay, so to summarize, so my hope was to convince you that Laguerre diagrams are a very powerful and suitable and efficient tool for discretizing optimal transport problems, and some other type of equation, like Monge-Ampère equation and generated Jacobian equations, which appear in optics, geometry, and economics. This is something I did not insist too much on, but I think that the discretized problem inherits many of the geometric features of the continuous ones, which suggests that it's a very meaningful way of discretizing. For instance, I believe that there is an analog of the continuous regularity theory for the discrete setting. And finally, the geometric inference from probability measure in a large dimensional space could provide insight on some variational problems, such as Brunier's general geodesics, so like the fractal behavior. Okay. So I will stop here, and I thank you for your attention.